I'm fond of talking about this topic because it never really ceases to amaze me. And that is the fact that we really live in extraordinary times. On the one hand, of course, it's obvious there are problems. And it really, for the first time in history, most of our significant problems are both man-made and global. So it's not like smallpox or hurricanes and so on. They are problems that are caused by human activity on this planet. And they're problems that cannot be solved by one government or one nation alone. So if you take global warming, what one country would do to help global warming is almost insignificant. The financial crisis, what one country does is insignificant. The so-called war on terrorism, but in general, the terrorist activity, anything one government does, almost insignificant. And at the same time, we have a consciousness that has, at least at its growing tip, at its leading edge, has grown through the first tier, for those of you who are familiar with that, the first grouping of human needs and drives and contacts, and is reaching in to the capacity to think globally. And so both humankind's problems and humankind's capacities have, for the first time in history, reached global proportions. Now, I can't really think of any time in history that has happened. And so on the problems side of the issue, we are really faced with looking at how to coordinate human activity across all of the national boundaries and attempt to get some mutual understanding, mutual activity, a growth together of nations into what eventually will be a transnational governing system. Now, this might take 10 years, 20 years, probably more like 50 years, to actually create a world governing, world federation system. But it's clearly on the way. As Habermas says, human beings don't just stand up next to each other and stand there. They attempt to understand each other. There is a telos in language that drives towards greater and greater and greater unities. And it has reached the point where these unities have gone from putting together villages to create the first small social organizations that are larger than a single village. And then villages grew together into early cities and city-states. Those grew together into the great empires. And then those grew into the nation state. And we're now on the verge of what do we do with a nation state? There are certain things, because of transcend and include, meaning each of these levels of development still has some important task that it has to do. Even early shamanic villages reproduce themselves in local community activity. where people have to get together and solve problems on a simple community block by block amount. And so that will always be there. But the issues of global climate change and the processes that are occurring there, as much as it's argued, most liberal scientists do believe that on balance, there is a rather severe problem facing us. And the sooner we come to terms with that, the sooner we're going to be able to do something about it. This is not an easy task because there's a whole political issue involved, which is the powerful countries with sovereignty are less likely to give up their power voluntarily. So we are kind of stuck with letting this process unfold and seeing how we can find solutions for nations that have the power to relinquish some of it in a non-binding way, in a way that is legally binding on the countries that surrender some of their sovereignty. So just to give a quick example, going back to the Kyoto Accords, getting to a point where individual nation states sign on to this conference and they agree that whatever the recommendations of this conference are, they are bound, legally bound, to follow. So we're seeing this sort of teeter-totter, 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 trying slowly to find ways that the nation states are going to surrender some of their sovereignty and play fair with the global commons and attempt to reach mutual understanding, lower left quadrant, but this time not just for individuals in a country, but for countries in Gaia. So again, never really happened before. It's an extraordinary occurrence. And yet just as extraordinary is the fact that human beings are at the point where increasingly we see evidence that they are developing the capacity to take on global issues in their awareness and to be able to spontaneously see these global issues, to worry about them, and to have their mind spontaneously and naturally start to think, what can I do about this? Because it's these people that, first of all, can see the problem. And that's a point that can't be overemphasized. Most people on the planet cannot see the problem of global warming. It takes a level of cognition that, as Robert Keegan would put it, is over their heads. And so right here, it's important to say that it sounds disingenuous, but it's not a judgment. It's not a nasty thing saying about people that can't see this, because growth and development occurs as fast as it can occur. And that is relatively slow on balance. We measure ecological and environmental changes in the hundreds of thousands of years as the smallest unit. And so we are at that edge where there is a remarkable emergence starting to occur, and that is the emergence of integral stages of development. Now, integral stages have several different meanings, but they generally came from the early researchers and theoreticians looking at human development. And almost without exception, they found that there were stages that went through, well, Gene Getzer's names for them are pretty self-explanatory: archaic, magic, mythic, rational, pluralistic, integral. Another way to look at that is in terms of moral identity, and that's going from egocentric to ethnocentric to world-centric to cosmocentric. The early pioneers almost invariably found that there starts out with stages of development that are egocentric, that the individual literally can't take the role of others. They can't take the viewpoint of others. And so their idea of care, compassion, love, needs, motivation is essentially themselves. And again, it's not a nasty, it's not they have a choice. Oh, I can be good and kind and sweet and compassionate and open, or I can be a Pol Pot, Stalin, Hitler, you know, dickhead. That's not the choice given to early development. It's just these are the stages that unfold, and they have to unfold in smaller units because these units become the building blocks of higher and higher and higher stages. So you take a natural developmental progression at large, and you see something like atoms to molecules to cells to multicellular organisms. And in each of those cases, each successive stage transcends and includes the preceding stage. And the preceding stage becomes part of the building blocks of the succeeding stage. So these stages are important. They can't be skipped. They can't be thrown away. They're the actual building blocks of the human psyche. And so the early researchers looking at these building blocks invariably found that they went from egocentric, self-contained, narcissistic components. Again, not because the person has a choice and, you know, could be nice and caring, but instead they wear gold disco chains and watch themselves in the mirror when they lift weights down at the local gym and all of this kind of stuff. It's just that's the only tools that the early mind has. But then it moves into ethnocentric, where it can take the role of other and therefore start to expand its capacity for consciousness, for care, for love, compassion, morality. And that reflects an ongoing expansion of consciousness in the developmental sequence. Abraham Maslow found that as the sequence occurred, there became a huge leap at one point. And this is the leap that is referred to as from first tier to second tier. And one of the main differences was that at first tier, and there were about six of them, the archaic, magic, mythic, rational, pluralistic, all six of those value structures believe that their values are the only correct values in the universe. And so it's a very partial, fragmented, I'm right, everybody else is wrong stance. And that is guaranteed to ensure culture wars going on around the world. And if those culture wars heat up and overflow and expand, then you get real war, like in the Mideast. And until we address these interior quadrants, which the State Department doesn't even know exists, which most of the people working on this have no idea is even there. And it's probably the single most important piece of information for international policy that we have. But Maslow found that as people moved through these first six, there was then the move into the seventh stage. And it was so striking, the difference between first and second tier. And because of characteristics in first and second tier, that Maslow referred to the motivations of first tier stages as being driven by deficiency needs. Deficiency need is like food. I'm hungry, I need it, I don't have it now, I go out, I get it, I eat, I feel better, I get hungry again, I go out, I get it, I eat, I feel better again. It's an endless round of deficiency motivation. But all of a sudden, when people moved into second tier and moved into this new emergence, Clare Graves found what he called a monumental leap of meaning occurred. And one of the main reasons is that second tier integral stages are the first stages that acknowledge the partial truths of all of the first tier stages. So they had an intuitive understanding that all of the first tier stages are important, and then second tier was more important. But there was still value seen in these first tier stages. Now, a society based on that kind of understanding has never existed in humanity's history. We have never had a culture that said, yes, your view is right, your fundamentalist traditional view is right and significant and important, your rational view is important, your mythic view is important, the pluralistic view has many important truths. We've never had a culture that included all of them. And so for us to see that happen, for a culture to actually have a society move into these needs, which incidentally Maslow called being needs, as opposed to deficiency needs. Because being needs are driven by a sense of overflowing, a sense of abundance, a sense of fullness. Not, I lack something, I need it. Not a scarcity mentality. But I'm so overflowing, I just want to share it. I want to go out. It's like somebody gives you $1 billion. What do? After you spend the first $500 million on yourself. You go out and you share it with your friends. You're so ecstatic. It's like, here, have some of this. Look, this is... And that's how people in second tier, that's how these abundance motivations act. Now, you can just imagine a society based on something like that, where people are actually giving away their emotional reserves and giving away their care and their compassion and their consciousness and their love. This would be extraordinary. And the evidence we have is that about, and this is very loosey-goosey, about 10 years ago, the percentage of people in Western cultures that were at second tier was somewhere around 2 to 3%. Right now it's somewhere around 4 to 5%. And people that work with developmental studies, most of the ones that I've talked to now say, well, we think it's around 4 to 5%, which is getting halfway to what we refer to as a tipping point. For some reason, when the leading edge of culture reaches around 10%, there's a tipping point. And even though only 10% of the population is at that stage, it reverberates through the whole culture. It changes the whole culture. The whole culture starts to adopt these values. Now, they can't fully adopt them because they're not at those stages. But the fact is, it has an extraordinary impact on every value level in the culture. And so we are at the point where many developmentalists feel that within a decade or so, certainly within y'all's lifetimes, 10% of the population is going to reach second tier. Now, when 10% of the population reached orange, or the modern stage of development, we had the French and American revolutions. We had the whole bringing in of representative democracy. We had the end of slavery in a 100-year period. Slavery was outlawed in every rational industrial country in the world. We had the rise of feminism. We had the rise of the environmental movement. And what all of these have in common is freeing them up, making them a part of cultural discussion, making them part of the values of the culture. And it's almost an automatic event when 10% of the leading edge reaches 10%, then there's this tipping point and it just starts filtering back through the culture. You will live to see that tipping point in integral values. And it will be an extraordinary period in your life, mine, and everybody really alive now. And one of the interesting things is that this tipping point, the second tier, this integral consciousness, is arriving at exactly the time that our global problems are arriving. It's seeing some kind of like almost synchronicity, like the problem arises, a solution or possible solution arises right after it. And this is something we see with tipping points in general. We talked about the orange tipping point that brought in modernity and environmentalism and feminism and end of slavery. In the 1960s, we saw the next transformation, and that was the emergence of green pluralism out of this orange viewpoint. And the green pluralistic viewpoint brought in a whole series of values that were incredibly important for evolution to go forward. And I've called these the many gifts of green. But it emphasized inclusiveness, that marginalization is bad and it should be left out, that we want to include as many viewpoints and individuals and cultures as we possibly can. And this was also radically new point of view, because most cultures were built on the fact of finding some groups you can reject. And we've never had a time in history where the stated aim of a culture was to include as many cultures and people as you possibly can. And so, as is so often the case, you see forerunners of it in the previous stage. So in orange, we saw this nation was brought forth and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. That is radically new. And that's what orange brought in, that you should be judged not on the basis of the religion you belong to, not on the basis of the skin color you have, not on the basis of your beliefs, but regardless of race, color, sex, or creed, you deserve full citizenship and full okayness in this culture. And so that was the initial introduction of that idea. And then it moved on with green pluralism. Green pluralism had one problem, and that is, although it could divide orange systems in a metasystemic way and see that these orange systems are there and that they are divided, there's not just one orange system that's true for every human being in the world. Orange can create systems, but they're monological, they're early, and they tend to be just one system. So the tendency of belief in orange is that just one system covers all human beings the world over. And this is something that we actually started looking at a little more closely and found that, no, wait a minute, there are multicultural expressions of these ideas. And we can't mush them all together. That this is a multicultural world with multicultural truths. Now, the problem with green is that it went too far and started to say things like, you can have no big pictures of cultures whatsoever. That there is no such thing as a big picture where something is true for every culture. But that itself is a claim for all cultures. So they ended up contradicting themselves. And as the postmodern, post-structuralist game played itself out, the so-called performative contradiction caught up with it. And the performative contradiction is, there are no universal truths except mine. Because that's universal, and it applies to all cultures, and it's my truth. So I get universal truths, none of y'all do. And that was bound to catch up with them sooner or later, and Carl Otto Appel and Jürgen Habermas, Charles Taylor eventually did. And it is generally just agreed that postmodernism is dead, or as dead as a philosophical movement can be. But there are still important things that we have to learn from it. But now, all of a sudden we're facing something that we have never faced in history. And that is all the previous transformations, there only, again, been five or six major transformations. Archaic, magic, mythic, rational, pluralistic, and the lower right quadrant, the techno-economic modes, foraging to horticultural, to agrarian, to industrial, to informational. So all of a sudden, all of those are there. And we are now prepared, and we see signs of moving into a truly unified culture. And that means basically that every human being has a truth, has some part of the truth. And the job of a culture is to take these truths, acknowledge the partial aspects of them, and then spend your time trying to bring them together, not spend your time trying to tear them apart. That's a first tier activity. So what we are faced with now is this extraordinary event where culture is about to make a leap that is, first of all, a stage leap like all of the others, but now it's not just a stage leap, it's a tier leap. It's going from stage 6 to stage 7. And that movement is also tier 1 to tier 2. So that's a huge, huge leap. And what does it mean? Exactly how is it going to unfold? The answer is we have no idea. Never happened before. We don't know. If somebody said, well, what's a transformation look like from magic to mythic, we could sit down and give you some pretty good guesses as to what it looked like, because we've seen them before. We have some anthropological studies tracking these developmental stages. Also occurs in human beings. Individuals born in today's world that go through magic, mythic, rational, pluralistic, integral stages of development themselves. So we have some idea about what's going on. With a tier leap, no idea. No idea. Except one thing. Each and every one of you in here is drawn towards integral. You intuitively, somehow, whether you can explain it or not, you are drawn into that second tier leap that's coming up. And for whatever reason, and there's, you know, really there's no reason to be either humble about it, overly humble on the one hand, or braggadocio on the other, but just take it as a fact. There's a small growing tip of individuals that you can call it grace, you can call it highly advanced, you can call it highly evolved. It doesn't matter what you call it. But the fact is, there's a small handful of people, 3-4% right now, that have been drawn to what is happening as second tier integral emerges. And do y'all remember that Close Encounters of the Third Kind? Remember Richard Dreyfuss in the living room, you know, digging mud up? I mean, he's got something is trying to express itself. he's not sure what it is, but he knows it's like, you know, one of the most important things in his life. And he's driven to try to express it. And that's what happens with individuals that move into second tier. There is this drive that might not be fully understandable to you, but it's a drive towards integral motivation. It's moving towards the superabundance, this overflow of motivation. It is something that makes you, sometimes in ways you can't understand, be pulled towards comprehensive solutions to things. You're not happy going to a doctor and getting just fragmented crap here, with none of it tied together. You're not happy with political situations, watching the Democrats and the Republicans, the independents, all at each other's throats, when you recognize that all of them have something to say. It's just ridiculous seeing grown men and women in these arguments. When we have if you're at second tier, you can look at this and see exactly how both of them make sense. They both have to be included. There is the same pull, the same drive, again, in education, in politics, in whatever field you're in. You are kind of tired of the broken, fragmented, pulling type of situation where there are three or four different schools in your discipline. Each of them convinced they're right and the others are wrong. And you sit there and it's obvious to you that all of them are right. You know, one of them is arguing in the upper right quadrant, one of them is arguing in the upper left quadrant, one of them is arguing in the lower left quadrant, and they're just sitting there trying to argue which one is real. And I mean, that's like arguing, okay, are my feet or my hands really real? Which should I go with? These kinds of things come up and start to bother you. And it's a quiet, insistent, sometimes existent, almost explosive situation where it's just driving you crazy. This integral awareness you have is this good news, bad news. The good news is you have a wider, deeper, broader awareness. And the bad news is nobody around you gives a flying fuck. And so you're kind of, hey, did I show you this book on, you know, integral consciousness? And your friends start running. No, they say, oh, look, here that person comes with that stack of Wilbur books. Get the shit out of here. It's all of a sudden you really become isolated. And I'm being really serious. It becomes a very isolated, lonely type of existence. So, of course, that's what we're trying to do, is create online events and then integral salons in the local area where people can get together and discuss these issues. Because one of the things that we find is so important for people is to be able to really just gather together with other people of a similar ilk and understanding. And you can just go into a room, more or less like this, and you realize you can talk and you don't have to explain yourself. You can talk and you don't get these weird sort of rolling eyeball looks. And you can be fully open and fully sharing of what you're doing. And you know that what's being heard is genuine, is real. People will really hear you. and really take the time to listen and to help your conversation move forward. So this is the good news and the bad news of Integral. And a lot of people, when they first get introduced to Integral, they imagine that it's just nothing but sweetness and light, that there's just everything, you know, gets better and problems disappear and you're doing totally cool. Everything is working out great. That's rare. It's rare. So one of the things that we want to do and that we, you know, are asking your help in is to, certainly in your experience with JFK and the great programs that they have out there, but think about when you get out and helping to create local Integral salons where once a week, every other week, whatever, people can come together and discuss these issues. And if nothing else, just hang out around a water cooler that is not orange and not green and just talk with each other and relax and start to feel what a truly integral congregation can feel like. Because it's unlike anything in the world. It's just unlike anything in the world. And I can't think of any time where a similar type of experience has occurred, where, in other words, sociologists and psychologists are sitting on the ocean beach, and because of demographic tests that they've done, they see this 4 to 5%, they see it moving, they expect a huge new wave of higher consciousness to come in. And they're sitting there, you know, with their instruments, you know, stuck into the beach, waiting. And they're going to get the data right this time. Every other transformation in human history has been a complete, radical, absolute surprise. And certainly the sociologists of the 1950s, not one of them guessed the dimensions of the transformation that was coming in the revolution of the 60s. And when it came in and hit them, it totally surprised all of them. And going back to the Western Enlightenment, that was a surprise as well. What we are seeing now, though, are educated, bright, sophisticated scholars, they say, sitting on the edge of the beach, waiting for it to come. And so what we want to do with Integral Institute, JFK, and several other places is, as I put it, we want to have the surfboard concession. We want to be there and go, hey, you want a T-shirt? So I really want to congratulate all of you, well, for being grown and evolved and authentic enough to recognize these impulses in yourself. And more than that, to have the strength and the courage to get involved in programs like this, where you have to overcome a certain, you know, sort of false humility and be willing to acknowledge, okay, I might be part of what's happening. And to do it in a non-boomeritis way, to do it in a way that understands there are ups and downs in this whole procedure, that it doesn't mean that the whole world is simply transforming, greatest transformation in the history of the world, a new paradigm is coming down the line, et cetera, et cetera. That's not what's happening. But about 10% of the population is happening, and you're part of that 10%. And so it's going to be an extraordinary change in culture. Culture is going to be fundamentally changed. And we have those two issues I mentioned earlier, where we have the problems that we face. Most of the problems we're facing now are man-made and global. And we have the possible solution, or at least the only chance for it, which is a cognition that's as global as the problems are global. These are both arising at the same time. I don't think it's coincidental that these two things are happening at the same time. So we have those occurring, and then we have the group of people that are actually driving this in terms of their own consciousness, their own cognition, their own awareness, their own psychograph, to be willing to step into it and say, okay, this is tough, but I'm ready to do it. I recognize the responsibility I have for being given this knowledge and understanding of global issues and global consciousness, and I'm willing to step up to it. I'm willing to step in there and assume responsibility for all of these issues. So the good news is this: the extraordinary growth and development and expansion of your own consciousness. And the other issue is stepping in and dealing with the world crisis as it's arising. And so some of you will choose more one than the other. Some will choose to emphasize global consciousness and go into studying that. It's absolutely fine. That's the problem-solving tool, along with the technology that it invents, will be the two things that help to solve the issue, should it be solvable. And so the other then is application. How do I actually solve this problem? What should I be doing? How am I responsible for this? And so being willing to step into that and to address that issue, to breathe that into your heart and keep it there and rest with that and come out of that invigorated and refreshed and ready to tackle problems that seriously only second tier, only integral awareness is going to be able to address. And so I want to thank all of you for that. That's no small step you're taking. And I bow to you humbly. Thank you.